From RTE Radio, I'm Niall O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
I could still see him, like, he had this blonde curly hair and he was so distraught. He was sobbing and terrified and so relieved to see me when we opened the door.
It's difficult to suggest that, you know, you may be a little overweight or you may be struggling with a little bit with, you know, your BMI. You don't even use those words with them.
Tens of thousands lined the streets of Dublin for...
Go on, say it, Barry.
I can't, I'm not.
Say
I will
it.
Not be forced.
Say
I will
it.
Not be forced into
Go on.
Coming up on this Pancake Tuesday edition of Playback Daily, how a real-life sleepwalking incident inspired a new thriller, the looming obesity crisis that's heading our way, and one man's campaign to keep Paddy out of St. Patrick's Day. That's all on the way over the next hour of the Radio Catch-Up Show that thinks it's maybe a little early for all the Paddy's Day talk. And so we leap straight into the Oliver Callan monologue from this morning. No pussyfooting around, no celebs, no Oscars, just a giant orange depression blowing in from the west. But first, a quick history lesson because, well, you never know who needs it.
The western nations of Europe and America stood together once against the threat from the east, and that has prevailed all the way from the end of the Second World War until, I think, 3:55 a.m. this morning, basically. And if you haven't been paying attention, the United States leader has suspended delivery of all the US military aid to Ukraine, which, from what I gather, if I haven't been sort of semi-concussed and over the last few days, it's a punishment for Volodymyr Zelensky's refusal to tell Donald Trump that he looked nice, smelled lovely, and really knows how to fill out a suit during that Oval Office meeting last Friday. Zelensky also refused to wear a suit himself and say thank you enough times. I don't know how many times he meant to say. I think he was supposed to say it so many times until it felt very uncomfortable in the room and borderline homoerotic in the fashion that J.D. Vance prefers. So he's being punished by being exposed to the invading Russian army that's commanded by a dictator, the democratic guy leader. OK, you're up to date. And for its brutal and illegal war in Ukraine, Russia's punishment is a new alliance with America against Europe, and also gold card visas for its oligarchs. That's one he dreamt up, I think, on the same, just the day before the slapdown of Zelensky. And also you've got this new elevated homecoming to the world stage from which Russia has been ostracized for 3 years for obvious reasons. But why Trump would want to be so friendly and so loving to Vladimir Putin, you can only, you know, attempt the speculative theory out there. It's anything from the PP tape compromat, remember of the first term? And all those jokes, anywhere there to the fact that the Botoxed butcher of the old Bolsheviks just says nice things about Trump's hair, his teeth, and the way he fills out a suit. So the American president whispers towards Vladimir Putin, "'Tis but thy name that is my enemy." It's like, you know, the Russia thing. No, I love you. And so a new global alliance has begun, the likes of which, now I've been looking this up and I've been doing some very, very constructive geopolitical thinking on this. This is a new global alliance that has begun. We have not seen this since the 1988 buddy cop action movie Red Heat. Remember? Starring Arnold Schwarzenegger and Jim Belushi. So Arnie plays a Soviet cop, Ivan Danko, and he teams up with Belushi, who's a Chicago police detective called Art Ritzik. And the Soviet cop comes into America, where he loves things like Cracker Jacks. And together they put aside their differences as representatives of the free market capitalism hedonism of the West versus the frugal moralities of a socio-economic order which was centred around common ownership of wealth. And these two enemies unite against a common foe. Red Heat is a beautiful work of art, and we are just seeing it play out again with the Trump-Putin alliance. Only this time, it's not at the expense of a murdering drug lord from a 1988 movie with a 67% rating on Rotten Tomatoes, but instead is at the expense of European democracy and values. And by the way, I don't want to make light of this enormously depressing ordeal that is the news right now. I'm just trying to cope as well. Of course, we know the Trump angle for balance. He says he wants the war to end, and he's against American money being spent where he feels Europe could pay more since it's our borders. And he has a point. He has a point. It's just weird that he won't criticise Russia at all, even just a tiny little bit. I mean, how much massaging of the ego did Mr. Putin do?
With all this awfulness going on, Oliver says, we need some froth and frippery. So, OK, I guess let's have some froth and frippery then.
And nobody does this better than Meghan Markle, star of Suits and also A Royal Wedding featuring George Clooney and Amy Huberman, that divided a kingdom. But at least it brought America closer to Europe for that brief shining moment that we had. So what is she up to? She has her Netflix new series. This is her comeback, Meghan's comeback, because it's been a rough couple of years for Meghan and Harry Windsor, to give him his name without the royal thing, living in California. It's a new Netflix series, which they postponed in January because of the Los Angeles wildfires. Tastefully done. Daily Mail coverage, first of all, says that on the day that Meghan launches her cookery series, the striking similarities to Pammy's bucolic lifestyle show are laid bare. This is basically a kind of a sneering... sneering accusation that Meghan Markle's new Netflix lifestyle series is remarkably similar to Pamela Anderson's one, which launched just a week ago. Pamela's show was called Cooking. It's Pamela's Cooking with Love. Meghan's is called With Love, comma, Meghan. It's streaming on Netflix today, by the way. This is where you will be hiding your head later on. Between this and Home of the Year, this is where you will be living, just to soothe your rattled soul. The two TV stars live more than 1,000 apart, but they're both smiling and giggling in brightly lit country kitchens, filming aspirational cooking with photogenic friends and famous chefs. Can't believe they're copying each other using exactly the very lifestyle format that has existed since the beginning of television. It's an absolute disgrace. Also, she's done an interview, Meghan, with People magazine, and the BBC, no less, a bastion of journalism, has listed the five things we've learned from Meghan's interview. Meghan says she loves Chinese takeaway. She has said she is not an influencer. She sees herself as an entrepreneur and a female founder. Well, she's founded females, fair play to her. She says her romance with Harry, formerly the artist known as Prince Harry, now Harry Windsor, it's like a honeymoon period again. Mentioned the book. And there's going to be a new podcast. Oh, this is just what we dreamt about. I mean, it's World War III or a new podcast for Meghan. Fortunately, it's going to be the latter. And her whole new Netflix series does not mention the royal family at all. They are the five crucial things you've learned, and now you know everything.
No, I know nothing, because I have no idea why so many men in the media hate Meghan Markle. I don't understand it at all. But obviously, I'm missing something, or something about her upsets people. Must be tough riling so many people up just for existing. Anyway, what's next? Ooh, property porn.
The Irish Times today, ahead of episode 3 of RTÉ's Home of the Year, which is going out tonight at 8:30, starring Hugh, Amanda, and the amazing new judge, who actually, I've deleted her name from my mind because I just see her as Joanne McNally. She is like, she's lighting up the show. Fair play to her, and I can't wait. They have announced, the Irish Times, what's in and out for home decor and design this year? Among the biggest shifts in how much thought goes into your home design this year. What's in? What's in? Okay, this is what's cool. Pet spaces in your home. It's the biggest shift in home design. How much thought goes into accommodating pets? Apparently some people have dedicated dog washing stations in their utility rooms to built-in feeding areas and smart storage for pet food. Wow. This is aside from the utility room. How big do the Irish Times think people's houses are? Also, home office is very much in. Dedicated home office, or at least a well-designed workspace in a room, is a must-have. That's not going to last, is it? All these American multinationals cancelling diversity and work from home. How long can it possibly last? Energy upgrades, yeah, we got that. Mud rooms, which I never heard of before. I think they mean boot room. But unlike a standard utility room, mud rooms include built-in seating, coat storage, shoe racks, even drying cupboards for wet clothes and boots. The trend reflects a more practical approach to home design. This has to be kept separate from your utility room, by the way. A must, I'd say, in country houses with Wellington boots and all that sort of stuff. EV charging points. Again, they're not looking at the future of the companies were going to cancel all their fossil fuel, that they reverse all that. But apparently a charging station is a must-have in your home. What's out? Ah, this is more like it. What's gone out of fashion? Smart home systems is the whole house system. So you like kind of dedicated app-controlled thermostats are fine, but the whole house system are gone out. Built-in coffee machines. Time was a built-in coffee machine was a cool feature in the kitchen, but they take up too much space and lack the flexibility of standalone models. Homeowners are instead opting for stylish coffee stations or breakfast bars where they keep their favourite coffee makers. And tellies in the bedroom are gone, out of fashion to reduce screen time. And you must prioritise a tech-free zone in the bedroom for better relaxation and sleep. Some people knew that the minute they put a TV in a bedroom in 1977. I'm presuming. Double ovens also gone. You don't need two ovens. They take up too much space. Telephone points gone for obvious reasons. Now, the Irish Times says another thing that's gone completely out of fashion. Solid fuel stoves are no longer hot. They're no longer in. It used to be a living room was complete. Could not be completed without a fireplace of stove. But in well-insulated homes, they're no longer necessary. I think you'll find Storm A-O-A-O-A-O-I-N made this one thing plain wrong. They are now an absolute necessity, I would say, when the power goes out.
Damn, I'll have to sell one of my ovens, obviously. That's the sort of thing that could lead a person to experience a...
This midlife crisis has been a feature of Western society. Well, we all know, yeah. Peak misery is between the age of 40 and 50. That's what I'm feeling, okay. But it's all about to change, aha. Happiness was once thought to be a U-shape on the graph. So the relatively carefree youth, then the really tough middle age, and then a comfortable later life. So the sad part was the middle, sagging middle, suitably enough. But the well-being experts, oh no, this is trouble already. They say our satisfaction now rises steadily with age. The U-shape in well-being by age that used to exist is gone, replaced by a crisis for... the young people, they are the saddest of all the demographics, youngsters. And the interesting thing is this Guardian report, the analysis took place in surveys in America, in Britain, in Ireland, Australia, Canada, New Zealand. We're rarely included in these world surveys. Study found life satisfaction, happiness felt among young people over the past decade, particularly among young women. And it's all about smartphones, social media and a well-being crisis and making everyone miserable because of social media bullying, cyberbullying and general and body shaming that happens online. The young people are isolated because they're stuck on their phones. And I'd say the Irish situation with housing may have dragged down that survey quite some bit. Young people, I mean, people are living at home with their parents in their 50s at this stage. And other studies have linked youth mental health crisis, intergenerational inequality, unregulated social media, insecure employment and the climate crisis. Young people increasingly likely to be absent from their jobs due to mental health conditions and so on. The UN sees it as a huge global crisis. And yeah, so the young are the sad people, middle age are grand, and the people later on, particularly from the 60s onwards, are apparently the happiest of them all.
Intriguing. Is that a nearer my God to thee sort of thing, or how do they explain it? I guess we'll just not know. Which is not a bad way to be, considering everything that's going on in the big bad world. And just like that, the Oliver Callan monologue extracted bits were at an end. Onward. According to The Lancet, Ireland is one of the countries at risk of a major surge in overweight and obesity rates over the next 25 years. Claire Byrne spoke to GP Maura Finn to get more on the report and the potential implications for Ireland.
So Maura, in general practice, in your own general practice, in your own experience, what sorts of rates of obesity are you seeing?
It's kind of hard to say, to be honest. We do try to take baseline levels on every patient that comes in, but it's imperfect. We'd have better numbers for our medical card population than for the private population, and better for adults than children. But it is, I would estimate it around 30, maybe just over 30%, which is higher than it would have been, you know, 10, 20 years ago. So we are seeing it increasing. These figures are quite alarming though, aren't they? But they are international figures. But we're definitely doing too well in that international kind of stakes there. We're up in the top 10 countries of the world, as you know, predicted as what our obesity rates will be by 2050, which is very frightening from the point of view of public health as well as everything else, health costs, general health, chronic diseases, and then mental health as well, because that's a huge part of people when they are obese or are struggling with their weight.
Do you think people are, in general, though, are aware now of the health risks associated with obesity, everything that you've outlined there? What do you think the awareness is in general population about those issues?
I think there's an awareness about the fact that obesity is linked to chronic disease, and it is in itself a chronic disease, and it's a complex chronic disease. However, what I do wonder is, do people, are they aware that they themselves may be in that overweight or obese category? And that's a difficult thing, and it's a particularly difficult thing in general practice. And I have to say, I struggle with it a little bit myself. It's a difficult conversation to start with somebody. Like, where do you start there? I mean, we're meant to kind of say, you know, is it okay to discuss your weight today? But you could run the risk of really upsetting somebody. And then there's that really fine balance, because eating disorders and disordered eating is a really big problem. And that population is very underserved as well. So it's difficult. So I feel that the onus should be on a kind of a public health education campaign that really tells people how to kind of look at their weight, not just about their BMI, but looking at their waist circumference and other things that actually are good parameters to actually kind of tell you whether or not you're in a situation where your health has been affected by your weight.
Mm-hmm. And when we see these figures coming from the Lancet and this prediction that, you know, we're going to have 4 in 10 people classified as obese here by 2050, people might say, well, we have drugs like Ozempic now. Is that not the fix?
Well, no, it's a part of the fix. It's a multifactorial issue. And there's so many different factors involved. Genetics, there's education, there's environment. Hugely important, it's nutrition and education around nutrition. And because it's multifactorial in its development, it's also multifactorial and complex in its management. And weight management clinics will have psychology, occupational therapy, physiotherapy, dietitians. There's a huge part, very big staff of people who are involved in this. So Ozempic and drugs like that are part of the solution, but only part of the solution. And I have to say, they're actually a very effective part of the solution for some of the people involved. But it has to go back to education about these ultra processed food, about maternal health and breastfeeding, about how our families feed our children and how school children leave school and go straight to the local garage where they get a breakfast roll or something worse that actually, and a sugary drink that's part of a kind of combined deal. That is how these obesity levels are going up. It's instead of actually teaching people how to feed ourselves in convenient food is not necessarily healthy food. And even things that are sold as healthy food are often unhealthy because they're full of sugars and ultra processed. It's about going back to basics. Mm-hmm. But I know we've spoken about this before, and it's a big issue. And I don't know how that has to happen, but I think it has to go to a public health campaign as opposed to, you know, trying to target individuals.
And if the problems start in childhood, in early childhood, in your experience, Maura, are they much more difficult to address?
Absolutely. And it's very difficult to actually bring it up in a consultation, in the scenario of being in a room with maybe a 12-year-old boy or girl, you know, who, you know, is obviously, what you will do is you'll talk about their lifestyle. Are they playing sports? Are they, you know, what are they doing? How are they eating? But it's difficult to suggest that, you know, you may be a little overweight, or you may be struggling with a little bit with, you know, your BMI. You don't even use those words with them. And I find it particularly difficult because I have a number of patients with eating disorders, and you do not want to be the person that'll trigger that with somebody as well. So again, of course we have to deal with the individuals. That's my job. That's our job as medics, to kind of deal with individual risk factors. But really the issue here should be a public health campaign and educating people about, like I say, nutrition. And how to, and the things that we can change. There's many factors around obesity that we can't change, but we should try and address the things that we can.
If somebody has obesity, though, I mean, are they past the point of being able to address it with increased activity and reducing intake? Or do you think that's still a good starting point? What do you do when you're classified as obese?
Well, you know, that is obviously the awful thing, you know, the idea that somebody who is obese is told to eat less and move more. And we know it's not as simple as that. And most often these people have struggled for years and have gone on many, many diets and have used lots of different techniques from an exercising point of view. So it's not as simple as that, but it is a part of the solution. And that's the whole thing. It's very complex. And to kind of say that only drugs like Ozempic will work, or only exercising more will work, none of those things work in isolation. It's about looking at the entire picture. But you do have to look at, you know, your lifestyle. Like, lifestyle modification is the most important part of this. Even if you put on a prescription drug, you know, if you put on a prescription drug like Ozempic, it may actually help you lose weight. And it does have massive effects for people who are pre-diabetic or pre-hypertensive or haven't quite developed osteoarthritis because of their weight yet. So I do feel that's a really big space for them. But they still have to exercise. They have to make sure that they don't just lose muscle weight. You know, they have to actually build up muscle while they actually are using these drugs. They need to eat a good quality food, high protein food while they're eating, because, you know, you reduce the amount of food, but it still has to be nutritious. So Do you see what I mean? It's the whole picture is what's so important here.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the figures in this Lancet study. By 2050, 80% of men over the age of 25 in this country will be overweight or obese. That will be the sixth highest in a list, which will be headed by Chile, Australia and Greece. What is it? I mean, you mentioned public health policy. What is it that we're getting so wrong?
It's hard to say. I mean, I do think it is public health, and I think it's how we've actually kind of developed this interest in convenience food. The idea, like, and you go into any supermarket and there are pre-packaged foods. There is meals that are ready to be bought. And I absolutely understand how these are necessary in some situations. But they are, you know, if you make your food from scratch, if you buy your ingredients that are whole ingredients, if you should only eat things that are actually something that is identifiable as a fruit or vegetable or whatever it is in its whole form to begin with, not a pre-prepared food, because they're full of sugar and it's all these other kind of trans fats, it's other fats that are in them. You don't know how they're processed. The cheaper they are, the more likely they are to have no nutritional value at all. So you've got calorie value but no nutritional value.
Guess that's my dinner going in the bin then. GP Moira Finn talking this morning to Claire Byrne about Ireland's looming obesity crisis. Meanwhile, on this afternoon's Ray Darcy show, Ray's guest was author Miosan Ian Kilroy, whose book Do Not Try to Become a Buddha has just been published. The conversation started with Ray just checking that he had the pronunciation of Ian's Buddhist name right.
Miosan,
Ian, Miosan.
Call me what you want.
Yeah, but is that correct pronunciation?
Yeah, you spot on. Well
right.
done.
And what does Miosan mean?
So Miosan, so I'm a Buddhist priest, Zen Buddhist priest. So when you get ordained, you get a Buddhist name. So my teacher would have given me the name Miosan, and Mio means wondrous.
Right.
And Zan means mountain. So when you're sitting Zazen, you're very much, when you're sitting in meditation, you're sitting in a mountain still state, they say in our tradition. So mountains are a big image in Buddhism generally. You know, the hermits went off to live in the mountains, and mountains were places of inspiration and practice. So that's kind of where it comes from. So I would have been, you know, a kid in the 70s, right? And during the 70s, there were a lot of travelling salesmen went around, and they were selling the encyclopedias, mostly the Encyclopedia Britannica. So my mum and dad in Galway had four, later six kids, and they said, oh, well, let's get this for their education, you know. So they spent, they invested in it. It cost a pretty penny.
It was expensive. Yeah.
It was, yeah. But it was a great thing to have. I mean, we eventually got rid of it. But in there was a feature on Japan. And in the Japanese feature, there was a picture of the great Buddha of Kamakura. Many of your listeners would know it. It's a very famous statue of a bronze Buddha. If they don't know it, if they saw it, they'd go, I know that, you know. And anyway, when I saw this picture, and I must have been, you know, 7 or 8 years old at the time, when I saw this picture, it communicated tranquility, peace, and a deep spirituality, really. So it communicated something wordlessly to me that in only a few seconds inspired me.
And you suffered with panic attacks.
That's right.
When did that come into your life?
So I suffered with panic attacks really in my 20s. I was, I had a great undergraduate time in Galway, having the crack in UCG, going to college. And then when I was doing a master's in English, you know, I was in my early 20s and all the big things about what am I going to do with my life? What am I doing? Am I wasting my time? You know, all these things were preying on my mind and trying to get the master's in English done. So I think it manifested in panic attacks. So I kind of started to re-examine some of those interests in Buddhism that were always just there in the background, you know?
Yeah. And Zen Buddhism, and you talk about in the book, it's a practice, not a dogma.
Mm. Mm.
So is Zen Buddhism a religion?
For me, it is.
Right.
For me, it is. I mean, is Catholicism, is any religion a religion? Catholicism is religion, Christianity is religion. It's also a culture. You know, if you think of Christmas, Christmas is a culture. We live in Christian cultures.
Strict definition, though, of Catholicism is it's a religion. There are cultural aspects that people, you know, that have seeped into the secular world. But
that's true. Yeah. I'd say the same is true of Zen Buddhism. So Zen Buddhist philosophy would have had a big influence on the writers, on the Beat Generation, on 60s culture and counterculture, including the hippies. So it's had an influence on, so people who are influenced by Zen Buddhism like that would see it as a philosophy or cultural phenomenon.
As opposed to a religion.
As opposed to a religion, as, and that's how I'd see it. But this is an onion, you know, it's got many layers. You know?
Yeah, yeah. And did it influence way back even the Stoic philosophers, or which came first?
Yeah, I think people always feel that there's a big difference between Eastern religious traditions and Western religious traditions. And I don't think that's true, because all of this stuff influenced each other down the Silk Road and the trading routes. There was a Buddha statue dug up in a bog in Ireland that had been there since Roman times, you know. So I think there's much more cultural and religious communication.
We're all human beings.
Yeah.
So it basically, it's all about the search for meaning. Is it? Is all religion about a search for meaning?
I think that's fair. I think that's a fair statement. I think it's a fair statement because if it's concerned with the meaning of life, if it's concerned with life and death and what it means to be here and how should we act, what's the right way, what's the right thing to do, you know, ethics basically and morality. If it's concerned with those type of issues, it's a spiritual tradition. It's a religious tradition. If it's to do with I want to feel better, it's also useful, but it's something different.
Right. I'm always curious as to whether we would be okay without the moral code provided to us by religions. I wonder if we have a sort of if we're hardwired to be good humans.
We're hardwired, it seems to me, to be both good and evil.
Okay.
And when we look around the world today, we can see many manifestations of both.
Of both, yeah. So Zen Buddhism, the practice of Zen Buddhism is sitting, zazen. Yeah. And you do this, just tell us your weekly routine.
Sure, yeah. Zazen, za means sitting and zen means meditation. The word zen actually just means meditation.
Okay.
So a lot of people have heard the word zen and they have lots of, you know, they think, oh, it means chilling out and all that. But the word actually means meditation. So what we do is called zazen, sitting meditation. So in the Zen school, sitting, zazen is something you do every day. Now, it can only be for a few minutes or it can be, you know, for half an hour or even longer sometimes. And what happens in sitting zazen is, imagine your mind is a bit like a glass of water with mud in it, all stirred up. That's often what we're like. And just if you let this glass of water sit on the counter for 10 minutes, it becomes clear and bright. And this is what zazen does to us. It settles us. It allows all the noise in our heads to settle down and we get a great feeling of peace and clarity. And I think that has to be a good thing.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's an oversimplification of it, to be honest.
Yeah,
When you start out initially, everything's going through your head, you know, from will I meet the mortgage repayment? You know, should I cut the grass now or leave it for 2 weeks? Because the man told me the other day it should be St. Patrick's Day. What am I going to put on the pancakes tonight? How is my elderly parent? Blah, blah, blah. All of those things are going through, racing through your head.
Mm.
What do you do with those thoughts when you're in a zazen situation?
Do you want the short answer or the long answer?
Well, the medium one.
Okay. Yeah, it's we're talking 2,500 years of tradition and writing and philosophy on this practice itself. So, but the medium answer is a good way to go because it's the middle way.
Which we'll get to the middle way.
I'm
a big fan of the middle way myself.
The middle way. And when you're sitting, can I say this, that it takes a long old while to get your head to settle?
It's tough.
It's a disciplined practice,
right,
and it's a hard practice.
Yeah.
It's not a quick fix.
But what I would like to know for myself and for our listeners, getting there to where you are, you're a priest. So the initial part of it, so that difficult part, if you could describe that for us.
Oh, yeah, definitely. There's three parts really to meditation. There's the body part, the breath part, and the mind part. So the first thing to get right is the body. So the body is, it took me, I'd say 6 or 7, maybe 8 months to find my body able to...
Your sitting position that suited you.
To sit in the way that suited me. So I sat cross-legged one way, I sat another way, I sat in a chair, and it's perfectly fine to sit in a chair, by the way. And in the end, I ended up in a half lotus position, which is one foot up on one thigh. You know, it's kind of the way you see yoga people sitting, really, you know. So I played around with that. So getting the body right is really
and
important.
And you're on a cushion.
Yeah, you are in a cushion, yeah. You're sitting on a cushion on the floor, right. Which gives you a great... You're on the floor, so you really feel grounded, you know, and stable, which is nice. But so getting the body right took a long time. Now, the mind is the other thing. So I was using the kind of image of a glass of water, and it does kind of communicate what's going on. Because when you're sitting down, you're thinking, like you said, Ray, you know, who's going to make the pancakes and what are we going to put in the batter? You're thinking about your problems too. They're coming up. Or if you have some trauma in your life, it might come up. Or if you have some hope for your life, you know, in the future, all this stuff is coming in the past, present and future. But what we're trying to do is just inhabit the present, just inhabit this very moment, which we understand is really eternity is present right here and right now.
Wow, that's Meo Zen Ian Kilroy, Buddhist priest, talking to Ray Darcy this afternoon. Ian's book, Do Not Try to Become a Buddha, is published by Wisdom. Author Carmel Harrington joined Oliver Callan in studio this morning to talk about her new novel, The Stolen Child. And Carmel began by giving us a potted autobiography.
I'm from Wexford, and I left Wexford at 18, very wide-eyed and innocent, to work with Aer Lingus.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and genuinely, I went to work for Aer Lingus because I wanted to see what was on the other side of the horizon. Mm. I always wanted to travel, and I figured that would be a great way of seeing the world for bargain prices. So I did. I travelled the world for 10 years with them, and I worked kind of in a sales role for them. So I ended up going to countries like Mozambique, South Africa,
wow,
Nigeria, the Philippines. So I was all over the world with them and kind of learned a lot about myself and about the world and different cultures during those years. And then I left them and I went into the private sector and I worked for an American multinational. Most people know them because they invented post-it notes, 3M. And I was kind of in a sales role with them for another 10 years.
Sales roles which require a chatty persona.
Chatty persona. Yeah. And I kind of, yeah, I travelled around Ireland for that. I wasn't in the air, I was on the road. And then I got married and met my husband, Roger, and we started a family. Mm-hmm. And while I was on maternity leave for my daughter, Amelia, who's now 15, I had already written 2 books, but I hadn't shown them to anyone. They were under my bed.
While on maternity leave, while looking after
No, I had written them before.
Well,
that.
You had like, already written
like I'd always wanted to write, Oliver, but I just never found the courage to kind of share it with anyone. I found it really difficult to say to people that I wanted to be a writer because I was, I suppose you're kind of afraid of being judged. Mm-hmm. And also if you say it out loud, then maybe you have to at least try. And there is that fear of failure and you never think that you're good enough.
Tough on yourself.
I was quite tough on myself, yes. And I always told myself, which I find hilarious now, that I was too busy to be a writer. And then when I had children and I got married, I have never been busier in my life, you know. And I really
that should be the impossible time.
It should have been the impossible time. And I used to write when the kids, you know, in between naps, I would write. And in the evenings, I would write. And I would say now that I have a dodgy knee and it's because I used to rock the baby's rocker, you know, with my foot while I had the laptop on my lap and I would write words. So it was kind of like, I don't know how I did it, but I did it when they were, you know, I had 2 babies under 2 and I made the decision, okay, I'm going to really go for this and see if I can get...
The brain was firing away. The whole
brain
time.
Was firing away, yeah. I was very inspired, I think, by the kids, really.
This is the first thriller, is it?
The first thriller.
What kind of novels have you been writing up to now?
Kind of family dramas. Now, they all have mystery and suspense in them to some levels, some more than others. But over the last few years, Oliver, I just found myself kind of lean into the dark side. I really enjoyed it. I don't know what that says about me, but I just really wanted to go for it. And then the idea for this book came to me quite a few years ago, actually, from a family horrifying moment. Yeah. And I just wanted to write. I knew I had to write this book. It felt like it was just the book that I needed to write. And I'm so glad I did. It was
a family holiday.
A family holiday in Florida. The kids were, Nate was 5, he's my youngest, and Amelia would have been 6 and a half. And the hotel was, you know, those hotels, the corridors are like The Shining, you know, Jack Nicholson's The Shining, the really long, narrow corridors.
Gigantic hotel.
Gigantic hotel,
Florida, yeah.
And we were on the 5th floor, but I remember we arrived to the hotel and everyone was shattered because it's Irish time versus local time. Anyhow, so we went straight to bed. one bedroom, two double beds, two massive double beds, actually. I do remember that. So the kids were in one and we were in the other, but like a foot between the two beds. And then I woke up at 3 a.m. and heard a banging on the front door. And it was very funny because I went to open the door. My husband stopped me and he said, Carmel, we're in America. It's 3 a.m. I'm ringing reception. Do not open that door. But I just got it into my head that Nate was out there. I couldn't hear him, but I didn't think it was Amelia, but I thought Nate was there, whatever mother's instinct you have.
And you've just stumbled in the dark through the room.
Stumbled in the dark, yeah.
Half asleep.
And I said to Rog, that's Nate. And he said, don't be silly. Like, he's asleep in our bedroom. So he went back in to check on the children and I opened the door. And of course, there was Nate. And I could still see him. Like, he had this blonde curly hair and he was so distraught. He was sobbing and terrified and so relieved to see me when we opened the door. Mm. And then, of course, we were, you know, the terror. Why is he in the corridor in Florida in the middle of the night? Like, how did he get there? Why is he there? And we were so confused. He was confused. But to cut a long story short, we figured out, you know, with time that he'd begun sleepwalking. Of all the times to choose to do it, but
what a time.
I know.
So he just got up unbeknownst.
He got up in the night. The first thing he realised was he was actually at the lift, which, as I said, was at the end of this really, really long corridor.
Yeah.
And the lift binged and it brought him out of his sleep.
That woke him up.
And he was in his PJs, of course, and he was looking around him going, this is not, like, where's mam, where's dad? And he realised that he was in the corridor and he was so terrified. And then he was trying to remember where the hotel room was. And I had said, luckily enough, when we were checking in and we got out of the lift and found our hotel room, I just said to the kids in conversation, we'll never forget which is our room because it's the last one at the end of this long corridor.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And he remembered that. And then, of course, he ran. So he said he ran so fast, but then he couldn't remember if it was the left or the right door, you know, and he took a guess and he was right. But we were so terrified and it began like for years, every time we went on holiday, we would have to barricade all the exits. So that there was a dining room table.
Because the sleepwalking meant he'd get up and open the door himself.
We found out, like, we went to the doctor, of course, and had him checked over and all the rest. And we found out, like, 1 in 5 children sleepwalk at that kind of age. But most of them don't do it again. But then some do it again. And Nate was one of those. He did it for years. We have so many stories, like family stories. And
did the doctor have any theory on why it would continue on or what?
He just said it was one of those things and it's actually hereditary. He asked my husband and I, did we sleepwalk? We don't. Mm-hmm. Had never. And then he said, either of you have night terrors? I have always had night terrors.
Really?
And he said, it's in the same family. And so, I don't know, I think it's because I have my imagination never stops. So it's even when
it's
I'm
the
sleeping.
The writer's brain, yeah.
I think it must be the writer's brain. And I think Nate has a writer's brain as well. He definitely has that imagination. And I'm not sure that's scientific now. That's just my own thoughts on it.
What age is Nate now?
He's now 13.
So he'd remember that.
He remembers it clearly. He remembers it clearly. And he said that he remembers me saying at the lift, you know, about the room being the last one. But he remembers being very scared and being afraid he tapped on the wrong door, you know, and the relief then when I opened it. But really what kind of inspired the story was, it was a few days later when I stopped crying. I mean, I cried for days.
I'd say you didn't let him go either.
No,
for the rest.
He slept with me. Roger was in bed with Amelia for the rest of the holiday and Nate was with me. And I just slept with my arm across him. He wasn't out of my arms for a long time. But it was actually Roger said to me a while later and he said, look at Carmel, you know, if we'd slept through and he hadn't found his way back to our room, who would believe us as parents that we could sleep through a child leaving the same bedroom? You're sharing this small space. No one would believe us. And so they said, so Rog was saying, you know, they would immediately look at us. And then my husband said, actually, they wouldn't look at you, Carmel, because he said, you know, you would be so emotional. Everyone would never believe you could do anything, you know, to a child. And I was thinking, yeah, to my husband, you're so in trouble because he's so measured. He's the yin to my yang, you know, he'd be quite measured where I'd be quite emotional. Okay. I thought, yeah, poor Rog now, he would be the first one in the firing line. So that kind of was the inkling of the story. And I thought, wouldn't it be good to explore a story where a child disappears from a very small enclosed space shared with the parents? And then the reader would have to try and work out along with the parents as to what happened at the end of the book. So that was where the story kind of came from.
That's author Carmel Harrington giving us the real life background to her new thriller on Oliver Callan This Morning. The new novel is called The Stolen Child and it's published by Headline. Before he can even reveal its nature, Joe Duffy tells Barry on this afternoon's Liveline that his noble, honourable campaign is lost.
You tell us what your campaign is And I'll tell you why I think it's over.
Okay, because I have a fierce objection to people saying St. Paddy's Day, because there's no such thing. There's no such thing in the calendar, St. Paddy's Day. You know, it's St. Patrick's Day. There was no such person as St. Paddy. It's just St. Patrick's Day, and that is the name of the saint. And he's our national saint, and he's our Irish saint, and we celebrate him with gusto the world over, and rightly so. But you even take an Irish mother, and she never christens her young lad St. Paddy, St. Packy, St. Pat, St. Paddy. He's known, he's christened Patrick. And no matter how many people around him call him other names, nicknames or things like that, he'll always be Patrick to her and her son. And, you know, the celebration of St. Patrick's Day, it's a phenomenon that we Irish celebrate the world over. And, you know,
do you object?
I remember...
Okay, Barry, just to clarify, do you object to... a lot of organisations leave out... No, they leave out the saint altogether. They call it Patrick's Day. Do you object to the saint moniker being left out?
No, I don't. Well, I prefer it. Let's put it this way. I prefer the saint, derivation or nomination
to be used.
I certainly object to the Paddy.
Okay. Are you ready? Have you a cup of... Are you sitting down, Barry?
I am.
Okay. Have you time to get a cup of green tea just to steady the nerves?
I will.
Okay, because I'm going to read out. In the last few minutes, I Googled Country Living, which is a very estimable magazine in the UK. It does hunting and Laura Ashley and highfalutin country houses. This is their headline on the 25th of February. Brace yourself, Barry.
It says celebrate
St. Paddy's Day with a homemade Irish meal. Are you ready for more? Come from the UK, from the home counties. Come to the home counties of Ireland, the closest we have to the home counties. Greystones in County Wicklow. Yeah. What does the Greystones guide say? Greystones.
If he says Paddy, I'll get him excommunicated.
It says Greystones Paddy's Day. And not only that, but they have stickers with Greystones Paddy's Day. Okay, Lovin' Dublin, which is a widely circulated magazine here in the capital. You get it free in a lot of restaurants. Brace yourself, Mary. Ten Paddy's Day events to check out in Dublin over the Bank Holiday weekend.
That is disgraceful.
Well, hang on, there's more to come, Barry. That's why I think it's over, Barry. The campaign is over. Galway Bio, which is a very popular website in Galway. And you think Galway of all parts of the country.
Yeah, of course.
What's their headline? Paddy's Day in Galway. What time is the parade on in my local town? Paddy's Day.
Yeah.
Okay.
George, it's not Paddy's Day, George.
Do you see, it's an abomination. Do you want to go academic with me now? Let's go toe to toe on academia. UCD website.
Yeah.
And it's a subsection called Nova UCD. St. Paddy's Day celebrations in UCD. St. Paddy's Day. Okay? Now, I'm not going to be left out. Trinity College.
Yeah.
Set up in 1492, was it, by the Queen Elizabeth. The Holy and Undivided Trinity College of Dublin. The headline this week in the Trinity News, recently in the Trinity News, which is the foremost magazine in Trinity, it says, in photos, tens of thousands lined the streets of Dublin for... Go on, say it, Barry.
I can't, I'm not.
Say
I will
it.
Not be forced.
Say
I will
it.
Not be forced.
Go on.
It is an abomination. It's too big.
Trinity
too
News.
Big. So,
tens of thousands
lined...
You are.
Am I swimming against the tide of convention, Joe?
Am I
wasting my time, Joe?
You are. You were hoping to swim up the Liffey. I think you're being dragged to the Isle of Man at this stage. Trinity News, tens of thousands lined the streets of Dublin for Paddy's Day.
They're absolutely shameful. Shameful, because there's no such thing as Paddy's Day. It was St. Patrick. to commemorate our national state. You know that, and I know that, and you've learned that he was born in 432, wasn't he? Well before the Academia of Trinity College came on the scene.
That's true, yeah.
And his name was St. Patrick.
Oh, Mother of God, well, Barry. Oh,
beatified.
Mother of Merciful Intervention. Look what I'm after finding.
What, Joe?
State College Police. The police are preparing for the state's Patty's Day. This P-A-T-T-Y. Barry.
Oh, dear.
It's gone.
I'm crying, Joe. I'm crying. You know, that's worse, Joe. That's worse, Joe. That when I went to England first, I worked with Aer Lingus.
I know, I understand. Yeah, yeah.
And that is worse. You get introduced to some English guy, then you know different other than this. You know, your man is, oh, and the first thing they say over their mouth is, Paddy, how are you? Yeah. You know, be Gara and be Jays, let's have another pint of Guinness. That was their summation of what I was being Irish was at that time, Joe. You know, were very proud of our heritage. I mean, the phenomenon of St. Patrick's Day is celebrated the world over. I have a friend of mine, Des Kennedy, and we marched in the parade in New York in 61. And, like, that parade took 5 hours to pass the viewing stand. And we marched in Aer Lingus uniforms and stuff like that.
Ah, course,
if you were able to walk in Aer Lingus, you'd be fired over to New York to march. And then when we were halfway through the parade, we broke off the parade. And then the Leash County, they had their James Fintan Lawlor banner. And they asked us to carry the banner for him as well. And we did that as well. But it was some phenomenon. A friend of mine rang me not too long ago. Joe, do you know where he was at a parade? One of the great parades, he said, in Macau.
Oh, Macau.
And Macau, and St. Patrick's Day parade in Macau. The biggest, one of the best parades in Europe is in Lanzarote every year. And I know an awful lot of people that timed their trip to the sun in the Canaries to Lanzarote around to coincide with the St. Patrick's Day parade.
Well, you know where I was once Grand Marshal of this. Never happened for me in Ireland.
Where,
but you know where I was once Grand Marshal and led the St. Patrick's
Grand
Day parade.
In what,
In the St. Patrick's Day parade in Moscow.
Thank you very much.
In Moscow.
I'm delighted to hear that.
Back in the night, I was in the Gay Bourne Show around 1994, and we carried the banner.
Yeah.
We carried the banner proudly.
You were proud, Joe, to do it.
Yeah.
You'll not be the Grand Marshal in Moscow this year, Joe, that's for sure. That's Barry and Joe Duffy agreeing for possibly the first time on something Paddy's Day related. Sorry, St. Patrick's Day related on this afternoon's Live Line. Finally, on this edition of Playback Daily, today, if you're listening on Tuesday, dear listener, is Pancake Tuesday, and that means debate over the best type of pancakes, toppings, etc. Chef Holly Dalton and Mummy Cooks founder Siobhan Barry duked it out on this morning's Today with Claire Byrne.
Holly, I was looking at your recipe for pancakes last night and it has vinegar in it.
Yes.
Do you want to just get that out of the way first?
That's not a typo, okay? This is real. This is not a joke. And I, even myself, basically that kind of happened as an accident. So traditionally, a lot of the times pancakes would have been made with buttermilk, and people use buttermilk because it has an acid in it. And generally acid is needed to activate either baking soda or baking powder, which is needed to make pancakes rise, which is, you know, all stating the obvious. And one time I was making pancakes and I didn't have any lemon juice and I didn't have any buttermilk. And I was like, you know what? Hey, let's break out the science brain here. OK, I'll just put in a bit of vinegar. It's essentially the same thing. And the pancakes rose better than they ever had before. And I'm talking about, like, this is a splash of vinegar. There's no like hint of vinegar flavor in the pancakes. Now, the batter does smell a little bit vinegary.
Oh, no.
No. Listen, it's all OK. OK, place your trust in me. And I'm not bragging. OK, but I put this recipe online, I think during COVID, actually, for the first time. I post it regularly. It is a fail-safe pancake recipe. It's also like very easily adaptable. I know if people have kids, often you want to make the pancake recipe a little bit healthier, add in a banana, use wholemeal flour, all that kind of stuff. And this recipe is a great jumping off point to do those things.
So we're talking about the American style fluffy, thick pancake here. This is what we're using the vinegar for, isn't it? For rising it, for making it rise.
Yeah, that's what my vibe is. Now, I really don't like when pancakes, you know, the way you can get a thick pancake and it's a bit stodgy and it's just kind of like thick for the sake of being thick. Mm-hmm. You know, it needs to be fluffy. And that's where the vinegar really comes into play. Like when you put the batter on the pan and the pan is nice and hot, obviously not too hot, you don't want it to burn. You're going to see it spring up like straight away. And when you flip it, you'll see that spring. And I think the vinegar is to thank for that. I don't think I've ever seen another pancake recipe that uses vinegar. And,
I haven't, but I'm going to give it a try.
Give it a go.
Today. Siobhan, your house sounds like my house in that pancakes are a weekly event. We have to do them every single weekend. Are you the same?
Absolutely, yeah. So it's, I think I started it because I actually wanted the kids in the kitchen helping me and they love pancakes. I go with a really simple recipe and it's one cup of flour, one cup of milk and one egg. And okay, we don't have great fluffy pancakes, but actually they're quite nice, lovely texture.
So the traditional pancake
Yeah, and the kids do it. And my kids now are a little older and they make their own pancakes now. And if they're friends over, they'll make pancakes for them as well. So if you keep it simple, I think that you're more likely to sort of get them into the kitchen cooking and, you know, trying new foods.
So there's no pancake mix in your house, you know, the ones that you can buy now in the supermarket.
Yeah, like I don't really understand that pancake mix because you still have to put in the egg and you still have to mix it. So all you're avoiding there is mixing the flour and the milk. Mm-hmm. And there's other stuff in there. I've heard there's palm oil in it.
Yeah, but so, you know what? Some people are a little bit scared, you know, of making pancake batter because it can go wrong. It could just be one of those things can go wrong. And then the first pancake is always awful, isn't it?
I think what can go wrong is that you don't have a non-stick frying pan and that it's not hot enough. I think that's where you can go wrong with the pancakes. So yeah, making sure that there's no lumps in it and then making sure you have a really hot pan. You're putting a bit of butter on it and then what I do actually is with spoons of pancake mix rather than
pouring.
A big pancake because then it's harder to flip maybe.
Mm-hmm. How good are you at flipping?
Well, again,
you don't
I just do one spoon and it's about four pancakes then on
Small
ones. They're much easier to flip. And also, again, going back to getting children to do it, it's much easier for them to be on a higher stool and doing that.
Mm-hmm. So toppings then, Holly, where do you stand on toppings?
I mean, toppings, you can go nuts with the toppings and I so often do. If you ask me what my personal preference is, you know, a very American style pancake would be maple syrup and bacon. I'm more a maple syrup and sausage kind of gal. I know maybe some people might turn their nose up at that, but it is absolutely delicious. I would highly recommend it. But I'll be cooking them this year with my toddler. So I kind of go on the healthier side then. I would use like yogurt and fresh fruit or even just like a little bit of jam. And it's great now because you can get a lot of Irish jams that are very, very low in sugar, which is handy. But even like a little bit of butter and sugar. I know butter and sugar. Listen, okay, it's obviously not healthy. Okay, I'm not saying it is.
It's
one day. Yeah. Who cares? Not as big a fan of the Nutella pancake situation. I don't know. I think that's a little bit overrated. But for me, maple syrup, butter, Irish sausages. Oh my gosh, that's what I'm going to have this evening. 100%.
Sausages. Just like the vinegar, I'm a bit thrown by the sausage.
Give it a go.
Look,
Trust me.
With everything that you tell us about on this program, we tend to give it a go, and it generally works. What about you, Siobhan? Favorite toppings in your house?
Yeah, I think again, this is an opportunity for kids to eat different foods, and by putting like loads of different toppings on the table and getting them to choose, they're more likely to maybe take the yogurt that they didn't take before, different fruit. I often make like a berry compote, so when we don't have fresh berries, I'll use frozen berries with a little bit of orange juice, and then the girls love pouring that kind of juice sauce onto top of the pancakes with the mashed berries then as lovely as well.
So would you put a bit of honey or maple syrup over
that
then?
Yeah, maple syrup probably.
Because it wouldn't be sweet with the orange juice on it.
Yeah.
Well, it wouldn't be sweet enough for my...
No, definitely maple syrup. And then with the chocolate spread, I tend to kind of not bring that out until the end.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they'll actually want that the whole way through.
Yeah, you have to kind of withhold that because they can... It's not just a little bit, is it, that they use? If they get at it themselves, It's half the jar. You mentioned, Holly, earlier on putting things like banana into the mix. So how does that work? And you mentioned science there as well. Like, does it change how it cooks then if you do that?
Yeah, so banana is kind of one of these miracle vegetables. Vegetables? Fruits? Maybe it is vegetable. No, it's pretty sure it's fruit. It's one of these miracle kind of ingredients, especially when you're trying to get fruit into your like kids' stuff. But bananas kind of work as if they are eggs. And also if you're going to use a vegan pancake recipe, bananas are often used instead of eggs. So you can kind of roughly substitute one egg for one banana. So I regularly make pancakes with banana instead of egg. And often, you know the way sometimes you wake up and it's a Saturday morning and you haven't done a shop yet and yeah. these are all over the gaff and then suddenly you're like, oh, actually, we don't have any eggs to make pancakes. That's where the banana comes in clutch, especially if it's these kind of like overripe bananas, might be hanging around the bottom of your fridge. It's really, really good for that. Another one I use a lot of is sweet potato. I kind of like roast some sweet potatoes often in the air fryer. They take maybe kind of 20 minutes. You're going to scoop out the innards of those, use that in a pancake, because I know for me, I've kind of have a picky toddler and getting as much veg fruit as possible into things is very important, and pancakes are just like a great vehicle for that. You can make like a sweet potato pancake or a banana pancake. It looks incredible, it's very appealing, it's very kind of kid friendly and borderline healthy-ish.
So well, it is. I mean, if you're you're going to replace the egg with the cooked sweet potato as well.
Yeah, that also works. It kind of has sweet potato and banana. They're kind of interchangeable. They both have kind of similar structural properties. Now, as well, what you can do, it does affect the texture a little bit. It sticks together really, really nicely. It maybe might be slightly less fluffy, not overly so. But even if you wanted to do like one banana and one egg, or you know, some sweet potato, some banana and an egg, that would all work like really, really nicely.
Out there ideas for pancakes for the day that's in it from Chef Holly Dalton and Mummy Cooks founder Siobhan Berry on this morning's Today with Claire Byrne. Starving now. And that's all I have for you on this maple syrup edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Shurathon. Don't forget, you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio app. And the mothership, that's Playback, is on air and in podcast land every Saturday when Sinead Mooney has a shinier, happier, peoplier look back at an entire week in radio. For me though, until tomorrow, thank you for listening and good luck. Oh yeah.